KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second forum hour, author Judith Levine decided for both personal and political reasons to do no shopping for a year except for necessities. She'll join us in the hour ahead as we open our phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to talk about your shopping habits and whether to consume or not consume. Can you not shop and drop shopping? Forum's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Journalist and author Judith Levine decided to enlist her partner in a year of consuming only necessities, and the result is a book that chronicles that year, Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. She's also the author of Do You Remember Me, My Enemy, My Love, and The Perils of Protecting Children from Sex. Her work has appeared in Harper's, The Village Voice, O, and Salon, and we want to raise these kinds of questions that her book raises in the course of this hour. Could you go a year without shopping for all but necessities? And how important or how vital is consuming and shopping to you? And what would you give up if it meant helping the planet or the sustainability of the environment? And I want to welcome Judith Levine, who joins us from Hardwick, Vermont, where she is in about 3 feet of snow. And let me say good morning to you.
Good morning.
I guess if you wanted to make your small contribution, as you said, to global warming, one wonders with 3 foot of snow if maybe you have succeeded in part. Huh?
Someone's succeeded.
Well, things aren't warming, at least in Vermont, if you've got 3 feet of snow. This actually, what was a catalyst to this was our fearless leaders telling us go shopping after 9/11. At least that was the start of the ball rolling with you, no?
You know, that's right. After 9/11, I also live in New York City, so I was affected by the World Trade Center bombings, and I was very struck by both Mayor Giuliani and President Bush when asked, you know, by the whole world, what can we do for you, and by the rest of the nation, you know, how can we respond to this? They said, go out, buy stuff, come here, go to restaurants, go shopping. It seemed to me a very cynical and narrow and wrong idea about what it means to be a patriot and what it means to be a citizen.
What it means to be a patriot and citizen is tied to not consuming in ways that can potentially harm our environment or harm our planet?
Well, yes. I mean, surely, you know, we have an economy which is dependent on perpetual growth. That is, everybody continuing to buy new stuff and throw it away and buy stuff to replace it. And if we don't feel like throwing it away, it will become obsolete even if we don't want to throw it away. So your new printer will not work with your old computer. And so we're always using up new resources, and very soon stuff goes to a landfill where it will off-gas until the end of time. That's a big problem. How can we be citizens? That's one of the really big questions of my book is, are we consumers or are we citizens? And is there a connection between those two things?
Well, are they always mutually exclusive? I mean, if you're talking about things that can harm the environment, you know, landfill and all that, you're talking about one area. But you were talking about just not consuming totally, to see
right.
if you could not consume anything but necessities.
Right. This is an experiment to see what would happen if we tried to, Paul and I, try to withdraw from the marketplace. First thing you learn within about 20 minutes is can't. You can't, and furthermore, who would want to? All of civilizations, that is social life, cultural life, political life, even personal identity, are enabled and mediated by the exchange of things and experiences. And in most economies, that means the paid exchange, you know, through cash or barter or credit cards. And so there's no not breathing the air that is around us. You know, we have to consume stuff. Furthermore, we get a lot of pleasure and gratification from consuming stuff. I don't really buy the argument that shopping makes you unhappy, which many of the voluntary simplicity people would claim.
Actually, a lot of people who find happiness solely through shopping.
Absolutely, or, you know, somewhere in between, right? So the dilemma we face is, in order to save our environment And I think in order to distribute more fairly the resources that we have on our planet, including the money, we need to exercise a certain amount of restraint. And yet our economy, and I would say just cultures and our personal lives, are enriched and enabled by this exchange and making of stuff, buying stuff. So on one hand, we have pleasure, the economy, social life, and all the rest of it. And on the other hand, we have a very, very big global problem of overconsumption. How do we reconcile those two things?
That's a big question.
Yeah, that's a big question.
And you say early on in your book, I'm just actually looking at a quote here, you say, on the average, someone living in a developed nation consumes twice as much grain, twice as much fish, three times as much meat, nine times as much paper, and 11 times as much gasoline as someone living in a developing nation. Among the high-income countries, Americans consume the most. Just 4.5% of the world's population, we use 24% of its resources and emit 23% of the greenhouse gases that are dissolving the ozone layer. And, of course, these are statistics in one form or another that we've seen before and heard before, but they do operate on at least a sensitive consciousness to say how to find restraint and where to find restraint, as you're suggesting.
Right, and I think the point of all those statistics is it's not just a matter of consumption, it's a matter of unequal consumption. There's a lot of people in the world who are not consuming enough. They don't have enough nutrition. They don't have enough space to live in. They don't have proper housing. They don't have medical care. So there are people in the world, lots of them, who underconsume, and then there are the few of us in what we call the global north who are overconsuming. So that's what, so those are all the great big questions and the big statistics. And what Paul and I tried to do was just trying to live day to day, see what it felt like to get off the wheel, off the cycle, and see what the personal consequences were of that. And then, what we might be able to extrapolate to the bigger world.
This is sort of like the Buy Nothing Day, but for a whole year.
That's right. In fact, I was inspired by Buy Nothing Day. Which is the day, if people don't know, that begins the Christmas shopping season the day after Thanksgiving, the biggest shopping day of the year. And Adbusters and Reverend Billy and a whole bunch of other anti-consumer activists get together to celebrate not buying anything. So on that day, actually, I went to Target, where people had, the doors had opened at 6 a.m. and people had rushed in to start getting bargains, and I talked to people who were in there, I have to say, having quite a good time, Christmas shopping. And then I ended the day at a Reverend Billy cash register exorcism in Times Square.
Talking with Judith Levine. She's with us this morning from Vermont. Her book is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. And asking our listeners, could you go a year without shopping for all but necessities? Of course, you get into that whole realm of how do you define necessities.
Yeah.
And for some people, necessities are totally superfluous to others, but how important or vital really is shopping to you, is consuming to you, and what would you give up in terms of shopping if it meant really helping and contributing to this or ameliorating this inequity of resources or doing something about it and doing something for the planet, for the environment? I'm going to open up the phone lines and, in fact, invite you to join us, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, and you can do that now by dialing in at 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls, and you are welcome to call us now, is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org is our email address. And just to come back to something you mentioned a moment ago, Judith Levine, and that is you want to see the personal effect. This is both personal and political. You had some psychological symptoms, actually.
I did. People talk about shopping as an addiction. I don't tend to think of it that way, but I did realize, one of the things that the simple living people say is that if you stop shopping, you will, unclutter your closet. You will find back there behind the old tennis rackets and shoeboxes your authentic self, crouching in the shadows. And I worried maybe I was going to find my authentic self and she would be a shopper. So I found, to my chagrin, that I felt often anxious and bored. I tend to think of myself as somebody with lots of inner resources, good at doing projects and political activism and reading books and the whole thing. But I realized that I, just like practically everybody else in a consumer society, often cures my momentary sense of anxiety or boredom or fatigue with myself or feeling ugly or fat or old by going out and buying just a little thing. And what Paul kept saying was, this for him was an experiment in getting to the other side of those feelings. You know, what will it feel like if you get through them? There's a wonderful English psychoanalyst named Adam Phillips, and he said that boredom is the restless state of waiting to desire. And what the consumer culture does for us is it gives us a gazillion names for desire. You know, Chunky Monkey, Ben and Jerry's ice cream, Kate Spade handbag, whatever it is, there's a name that you can attach to this very vague, inchoate desire. When you don't have those names, you kind of have to figure out what you want. And maybe the answer is nothing.
We're both admirers, Adam Phillips. In fact, we've had him on forum here. You learn a good deal. I mean, you have certainly learned a good deal in this whole process about the nature of boredom. But I think even more significantly than that, you learned what it meant to be a better citizen somehow. I mean, talk about the outward from the inward, for example, and you talk about moving inward in a way that really brings about a greater enlightenment. This is almost, if I dare say so, Buddhistic in some ways, or certainly ascetic in some ways. That is, you know, keep down the impulses of desire in the flesh in order to lift up the spirit or go to another level. You did kind of reach another level, you and your partner.
Yes, well, you know, that's one way of looking at it. And I think surely the renunciative traditions, the Buddhist tradition, or even the American environmentalist traditions such as John Muir or Thoreau or... are about what you're talking about, which is to go without material things in order to find some deeper spiritual meaning in life. And, you know, that's a fine and long tradition. For me, the results were more social and political than they were spiritual. We are very much encouraged to think of ourselves in America as consumers first. We think of ourselves even as consumers of our government, you know, as if the government were some sort of company that we're making a product, and if we don't like it, well, we're not going to pay for it. We're not going to pay our taxes. But when you stop consuming, Paul and I were thrown out into the public sphere to find our meaning and our stimulation and our fun. We went to the park. We went to the public library. And we felt very grateful for these things and also quite distressed by the shabby condition that they are in. And we saw a very direct relationship between the amount of time, money, and passion that we pour into private consumption and the amount we're willing to invest in the public good. And so this experience transformed me in a big way from consumer to citizen. I realized that if I want those things in the public sphere, which are not just helping the poor who can't pay for them, they're helping me. And they're helping rich people, too. You know, you get on the subway in New York City, there's stockbrokers going down to Wall Street. So everybody gains by this collective investment. And that's about not just about money. It's about time. It's about thought. It's about commitment. Those are all of the actions and qualities of a citizen, not of a consumer.
We're talking to citizen more than consumer, Judith Levine. Her book is Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Barbara Ehrenreich says, I love this book. And Bill McKibben says, an important book. And we'll find out what you have to say about this whole notion. Amy, good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just think it's ironic, having recently moved to San Francisco from Vermont, that it was the movement to Vermont that helped your guest to start to appreciate that we live in this kind of consumer society. Because after all, when I left, there wasn't a Walmart there. I don't know if the Walmart in St. Albans actually got built or not. It was pretty controversial. But I also appreciate that the political implications for our society are huge, and that in the cities where you can't drive for more than a block without being bombarded by opportunity to consume, that there are not a lot of people making the connection between consumerism and the political process in which we live. And that was my comment, and I'll listen on the radio now.
All right. We thank you for the comment, Judith Levine. I don't know if you want to respond to that comment. Or...
Well, Amy, thanks for calling. I actually live half the time in Brooklyn, New York. So I live in, you know, the cauldron of consumer society.
You're like Grace Paley. What a contrast. Huh?
That's right. Grace says, I miss New York. I miss everyone in it. So we live Right. In a very rural place where, if people don't know Vermont, one of the things about Vermont is in the 1970s they passed a no billboard law. So you actually drive down the road and there are no advertisements. So,
well, you've got a socialist senator.
We have a socialist senator. And so you can actually live here and you can go for days and days at a time without being pitched to at all. And yet, of course, as Amy says, the minute you walk out your door in the city, there are many, many, many opportunities to buy things. And so it was quite interesting. And furthermore, having fun in the country is often free. And while there are lots of free things to do in the city, you know, just meeting up with a friend generally costs, you know, at least the price of a cup of coffee. A friend of mine says it costs $10 an hour just to be in New York City. So, you know, how do you live?
Depends what part of New York City you're in, I would submit.
What?
I say I would submit it depends on what part of New York City you're in.
It costs you $25 an hour. So, you know, how do you live in a place where you're always being exhorted to buy things, where there are, frankly, lots of really nice things to buy? One of the solutions that I came up with was I just began to look at shops like I look at museums. I don't need to own the Picasso. I can go visit it and look at it and enjoy it. And so I can just look in a shop window. The French call window shopping la lèche vitrine, which means to lick the shop windows. And so I thought of it that way.
And we bring on more of your calls. Brian, join us. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Hey, a quick point I wanted to make and kind of look at a thematic level is that I'm listening to you on my way into work, and I can't help but reflect on the fact that we live in a kind of a specialized society in which we're all both consumers but also producers. And if nobody consumed what we produce, we would all have trouble putting food on our plates and roofs over our heads. And so I just wanted to listen to Judith's comment on the interconnectedness of our society and the fact that a certain amount of consumption as well as production is important for it to work. And I just kind of object. I will admit to objecting to the sort of self-righteous or righteous indignation against all consumption in the sense that it's just, it is another aspect of our society that we need.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Brian. I don't have any righteous indignation against consumption, and I completely agree with you that it is part of the very fabric of social interaction of civilization since the beginning of civilization. The point you bring up is really important, which is how do you have an economy without a whole lot of consumer activity? There are a lot of environmental activists, economists who have thought about this far more deeply than I have. One of those people is a guy called Herman Daly, who is the person who came up with the term sustainable economy. And what Daly says is you can have two kinds of economies. You can have a growth economy, that's the kind we have, which will inevitably outgrow its finite space, that is our environment. So you can grow and grow, but you can't grow too much because you'll end up just using everything up. So that's not sustainable. Then you can have what he calls a development economy, and that's an economy in which, yes, you continue to produce things, but you produce things that last longer, that might be more expensive, but which don't obsolesce, that are less resource intensive, that don't use as much fossil fuel, for instance, that don't have to get shipped all over the place. You can support local economies so you're not spending 50 cents out of every, you know, dollar of oranges to ship them from Chile to New York City. And then also there are many other things that we do, services and experiences that don't add to the junk in the landfills. And then the last thing is that economies and policymakers make conscious decisions about whether money goes to public spending or private spending. And so you can improve the environment, you can have livable cities, you can have public transportation. All of these also give people jobs, create tax revenues, you know, keep things moving along without being quite so detrimental to the environment and the people on the earth.
Before I go to more calls here, just a reminder, we're talking to Judith Levine. Her book is Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Some emails here. A listener writes, this is a fantastic counter to the marketing bombardment we suffer through every single day. Bravo. followed by many exclamation marks. Here's a listener who says, I decided to have a car-free year starting last October 26. Since then, I haven't bought anything. I can't carry home on a bicycle or bus. It's not buy nothing, but it's certainly buy much less. And then we have this sort of reaction from a listener who says, what a hypocrite. The speaker complains about excess consumption and then comes on the radio to sell her book. A good first step in cutting consumption would be not to buy her book.
I have been asked this listener thinks that he or she just came up with this, but I can assure you that many people have had the same objection.
Well, another listener wants to know, what were your constraints? Did you cut off your phone and cable? And he wants to know, where did you get food, toilet paper? Did you pay electric bills? I mean, these are all...
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
I mean, we did all of those things. We don't have cable. We, you know, the question of what a necessity is a huge one, and it's a very fluid line. And
Judith, forgive me, but Q-tips are a necessity for me.
Q-tips are a necessity. Now, I decided unilaterally that Q-tips are not a necessity, much to the disappointment of my partner, but he went along with me, and that was the first thing he bought on January 1st of 2005. All of these, that question, what's a necessity? If I lived in Los Angeles and I had a job 30 miles from my home, I would have no choice but to get in a car or maybe get on a bus if there was one near me and go to my job. Lucky for me, I work at home. Half the year I live in New York City. I also use my bicycle or take the subway, never have to drive a car. And what that points out to me is that we have to have social policies to make it possible for us to consume less. I mean, if there's no public transportation, there's nothing you can do about using a car. What does that mean? It means as citizens we have to get together and try to demand that there be public transportation. On the note of hypocrisy, buying my book, I have told people that you can also use it for fuel, put it over your head if it's raining, and if worse comes to worse, it's a vegan alternative to pâté de foie gras.
All sorts of utilitarian uses. Here's Frank, who raises a question. Because we live in a consumer-dependent economy, any predictions what would happen to the economy if a substantial number of people cut back on consumption?
Well, I just heard last night, actually, from Bill McKibben that Europeans, who anybody who's been to Europe can attest, have quite nice lives, consume 50% as much as Americans do in private consumption. That's everything from fuel to things. And so that means they live in smaller houses by and large. They drive smaller cars. They buy their food more locally. They probably buy less food than we do, and they don't buy as many consumer items. They pay higher taxes, and so they have less disposable income to go out and buy those things. But that's a lot. It's a lot. I read recently that in the average Japanese home, also people use less than half of what Americans do, and that's because they turn off their lights and their heat when they're not in a room, and they have these little personal fuel cells, which their government gave to them, $50,000 a pop. They provided everybody's household with a fuel cell.
We're coming up on a break, and I just want to mention, since I mentioned at the top, that Judith Levine indicates in her book that one of the things that motivated her was her desire to make her small contribution to global warming. She mentioned Bill McKibben, who, of course, has appeared on Forum before and who has an excellent article about new research on global warming that I wanted to reference here that I just happened to read recently and is accessible on the web. And we're accessible, too, if you'd like to join us and talk about to consume or not to consume and what your habits are vis-a-vis shopping. Our email is forum@kqed.org. Our phone number, toll-free, 866-733-6786. And we'll continue with your calls and emails. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with journalist and author Judith Levine about her book and questions raised in that book that are indeed very formidable questions that all have to do with whether to shop or not to shop and how we comport ourselves as consumers. Her book is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping, and it chronicles a year that she and her partner Paul decided not to shop except for necessities and what it brought out in the way of thoughts, both political and personal. Again, we welcome your calls on this subject, and our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and let me go to more of your calls, and we begin this second half hour with Jessica from Palo Alto. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I'm really interested in this idea of using consumption to bring more equality and inequities in consumption. And I'm interested, what about the idea of spending a year only shopping fair trade or only shopping to support cooperatives or economic movements in, quote unquote, the global south?
I think that's, you know, that's something that a lot of consumer activists or just, you know, people like yourself who, you know, who are trying to do the things, to do differently the things that they would do anyway. So if they're going to buy coffee, they want to make sure that they're going to buy coffee that not only pays a fair wage to the farmer, but also, you know, doesn't use pesticides that are going to make bean picker sick. And so those are very, I think, very useful and positive movements. Another thing that McKibben has talked about, for instance, is supporting your local economies and having, you know, to eat locally as much as you can. You out there in the Bay Area are lucky that you have all year round, you know, really wonderful produce and that you can eat. Up here in Vermont, you know, we'd have a pretty narrow diet during the winter if we tried to depend on just what we could grow around our homes. But I think those are extremely important things to do, and they just speak to the question of, you know, of conscious consuming. When people ask me, you know, what could I do to cut down on my consuming or to consume differently, what I say is try to think about the life cycle of this thing you're going to buy. Where did it come from? What resources went into it? Who made it? How much did that person earn? How much fuel did it take to ship it from that place to the place where I'm buying it? And where is it going to go when I'm finished with it? And what's going to happen to it?
A caveat may be in order here, though, Judith, if I may, because I remember when Barbara Kingsolver brought this up on the air, and it got into my consciousness and ferreted in ways that you can't even imagine. Suddenly, I couldn't go to the grocery store without thinking about just virtually every item and where it came from and what kind of labor went into it and all of that sort of thing. You know, it can overwhelm you.
You're right. It is overwhelming, and especially in a globalized economy. And you don't know. You know, you don't know where it came from. And with the plethora of consumer goods there are, my goodness, you know, every time you want to buy a bottle, a jar of jam, there's 30 jars of jam on the shelf. You know, you could go crazy. But there's a big, you know, range between no consciousness and too much consciousness.
And we'll thank Jessica for her call and move on to more of your calls. And we go next to Joanne. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks. I love your show. I've been listening to it my whole life. I love it. Anyway, I'd like to say, first of all, that I agree with everything you said. And I myself grew up with no car and no TV. Am I on the air?
You are on the air.
Oh, it's always so hard to hear yourself. I still don't have a car. I buy my clothes at Crossroads in Buffalo, kind of neat local thrift stores, although more out of necessity, although I have a great wardrobe, than desire. I loved her example of looking at clothes, like looking at paintings. I myself love to window shop and even go in and try on fabulous expensive clothes, and maybe one day I'll be able to buy a $5,000 dress. But I'd also like to say, so even though I agree with everything, her comment comes from a point of privilege. It's only when you have that you can say you can do without. And I just like to give a brief example that always sticks in my head. During the Bosnian War, remember there was a reporter, a woman, and she said that she had lost everything, her family and her house. And she said someone had made the comment about her still going out in some beautiful pair of high-heeled shoes. And she said it was all the more important when you don't have anything to have that incredible pair of shoes. And I can tell you, when you have no money, to be able to go to a Walgreens or Target when you only have a couple of dollars and pick up some cute little shirt is really helpful. And just as a final thing, once again, although I agree with everything you've said, you live in both Vermont and Brooklyn, you have two places. I mean,
I know, because, well, I have a boyfriend who has a house in Vermont.
I'm just saying that one can, when you speak of that, I'm just saying it comes from a point of privilege. Anyway, thank you very much. And as I said, I agree with everything you've said.
Thank you for
your call.
Well,
thank you for those comments. And I think that those points are very, very well taken. And they speak to lots of different things. First thing, just to clarify, you know, I I'm a writer. I don't earn a lot of money, but I met a man when I was 40 who lived in Vermont, and so we live here sometimes and rent my apartment in New York, and then we move back there and rent this house. So we're very, very lucky to have that. So there are two things that you said that, that were evocative to me. One is that, the feeling of and the experience, the reality of want. And as I said before, there are many people in the world who are under-consuming. But then the other thing is about the pleasures of consumption when you don't have other stuff. I remember years ago in the Reagan administration, there was Reagan came out and said that people shouldn't be using their food stamps to buy beer. And there was a big dispute about it. And what the point that people came out with was to say, you know what, if you have a crummy job or you don't have a job, I mean, everybody deserves to sit at the end of a hot day in the summer on their stoop and enjoy a beer with their friends. You know, this is, call it a luxury if you want to, but everybody deserves it. And those small purchases or big purchases, I say over and over in my book that there is great pleasure in buying stuff, and I don't.
Are we making a brief here for beer consumption?
Yes, I am. All sorts of intoxicants, I'm in favor. But you're right that privilege allows you to make choices. But I do think that we still. One of the stories I tell in my book is I'm in a cheap store. I had to buy some clothes for my father who was in a nursing home. And people were buying lots and lots of inexpensive clothing. And there was a young woman in front of me. She had about 17 sweaters in her arms. And so I began to think, like, judgmentally about her. Why does she have so many? Why is she being so nasty to me? Blah, 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 blah. And then I thought, well, if those sweaters were made by somebody who earned a decent wage, then possibly this woman, and if this woman were not being offered 72 credit cards that she can't pay back, particularly if she can't pay them back, she's being offered them, then maybe she would buy one sweater. Maybe that woman in the other country would have, a better life. If there were international unions so that you weren't going to be undercutting the Chinatown worker by the Chinese worker or vice versa, then people might consume less, but they might also have, in general, more decent, secure, and happy lives. And so I don't think that it's always a trade-off of consumption or not consumption. It is true that the privileged always have more choices than those without privilege, and yet I think that there are many, many ways that we could change the ways in which we consume and in which we compensate people that would make it fairer and more satisfying to live for everybody.
These are such, again, as you indicated earlier, large and looming and exceedingly difficult questions. You hear people say, for example, I don't want to consume this product because it's made at the expense of workers who are oppressed and who need to be unionized. And then you talk, as we have, for example, on the air here, to those who are the supposed exploiters of that labor, and they say these are people who make a living and feed their family, and if they didn't have this job, they would have nothing.
Exactly, yeah.
It becomes very morally complicated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I just wanted to make that note as we go to more of your calls. David, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Michael. Well, Judith, I haven't read your book, and I have to kind of echo what the other person just said, the woman that called about you're speaking from a point of privilege, and I think most of us listening to this program are probably in that position. And some folks that I have known that have gone to the simplified life are the ones that have a house, well-furnished, a pension from AT&T, and a $350 bike that they use to ride up and down the coast to show that they're socially conscious and don't use gas. I really think what we need here is a very difficult to construct systems dynamic model that looks at the real cause of this, and that is human desire to expand, both population-wise, territory-wise, power-wise, etc. And just the nature of that creates consumption. If I go across the hill and I find something different, better tasting, a spice, a view, anything, I come back from where I came and I tell people, they say, well, I got to see that too, or I want that. So that that need to expand is built into our human nature to explore. And I think that drives consumption. No one really seems to get serious about talking on an international basis. What do we do with the future of population? And our economy system is built on increasing population and increasing consumption. Can we really stand to have a balanced homeostatic economic system in the world?
Well, those are giant, you know, this is kind of a giant way of looking at it. And I just wanted to say that, you know, my book is very small. You know, it's really about day-to-day life. And it does try to, you know, think about these big questions. So just to, you know, make a little plug for the book, it's funny and it's kind of, you know, I guess I tried to come to it from, you know, representing like an ordinary person. I'll reveal my income. My gross income is around $40,000 to $50,000 a year. I'm a writer. That means I pay all my own health insurance and all the rest of it.
It means you make more than most writers, actually.
Yeah, I do. And I edit and I speak and I, you know, do all kinds of things to make it happen. So so I make a kind of an average middle-class income. I don't have a lot of savings. I'm worried about, you know, I have no pension. I'm putting away as much money as I can and stuff. So I think I have, you know, a fair amount, probably an average amount of insecurity, but not a terrible amount of insecurity. And so, and I'm kind of an average shopper. You know, I like to buy stuff, but I'm not, like, avid. So I just try to, you know, use myself as an example. Of course, each individual is different. So, but from what the caller just said, though, the thing about what he calls the human desire to expand, my own view of this is that there's no such thing really as human nature, that humans are very much shaped by the culture and the moment in history they live. There were many, 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 probably millennia during which people never even had the idea that they would ever leave their village or ever leave their class or, you know, they would become the same thing that their father or mother was. And so they didn't necessarily have a desire or a sense that they could expand. Having said that, we do now. We get on planes, we watch television, we can eat foods from all over the world, and so probably we're not going to go back. So then the question is, you know, how can we, in a reasonable way, exercise a certain amount of restraint? What are the trade-offs? You know, if getting on planes all the time means that we're not going to have any air in the next, you know, with, you know, two generations to breathe, well, is it really worth it getting on those planes all the time? We might think differently about going over the hill and getting that view just because we'd like to see it.
It depends, too, on a kind of a calculus. And, I mean, there are people, for example, who will not drive an SUV and who are very dedicated to the environment in that sense, and yet they'll have a private jet, talk about privilege, and fly around in it and consume much more in the way of gasoline. I mean, these are things that really ought to be quantified. Sometimes
they
need to be.
Yes, you know, they should be. And, you know, people are, you know, what I end up saying in the book is that this is really not going to be solved by us one by one. The only way I think that we are going to be able to solve these very big international questions is by having large-scale policies so that, for instance, if there were high fuel emission standards, then there would be no gas-guzzling cars produced and people would not have to make a moral decision or a personal decision to sacrifice every time they bought a car. They just wouldn't have the choice to buy a gas-guzzling car. A good social policy and good economic policy makes it easy for people to do the right thing. Now, what the right thing is a matter of dispute, and that's what politics is about. How much restraint are we going to have? Who's going to restrain it? Is the government going to do it? How much is going to be voluntary? Those are all political questions, and they're not a matter of me deciding whether I'm going to buy this CD or drive that car or not. They're really a matter of citizenship and not just consumerism.
Well, the biggest question, it seems to me, that ties in citizenship and consumerism is a question of sustainability. I was remembering when David Brower was last here before he died, and we were talking about progress, and I was reminded of E. Cummings' line that progress is an uncomfortable disease. If you keep moving forward and you keep progressing, you do so obviously at the expense of the planet, the carrying capacity, and all the rest. So big questions have emerged here, to put it mildly. And so also has emerged some emails from individuals who have responded to some of what we've been talking about. This is Dan, who says, I think that this discussion brings up the trade-off between necessities and wants. Further, I believe that the trade-off between necessities and wants only makes sense in the context of one's goals. If I had a goal to run a marathon, it would be in necessity for me to buy new good running shoes. Without that goal, buying new good running shoes would simply be a want. I personally believe that too often people do not make goals. I think making goals makes it possible to make better decisions about what we, in fact, deem necessities. And here's Jay, who says, talking about real consumption is one thing, but it might be good to talk about craving more than we need and just buying or acquiring more than is necessary. That is truly the American way. We have shiploads of goods waiting at ports around the country, waiting to unload everything from essentials to pure vapid junk, and yet it is all put into the marketplace as valid consumer goods. And a listener named Autumn writes, I began the practice of non-consuming after starting a small home business. It has been about a year since adopting this, and it's been more difficult to explain to my friends with steady paychecks that I was often not allowing myself to take part in various activities like going out to dinner or to a movie or even taking a long drive to visit them. I even try to make my own bread and cook things that I could otherwise buy prepackaged. Newt from Kensington says, thank you for another great program. With respect to shopping, my wife has taught me a middle way. She primarily uses thrift and consignment stores. They are often run by humanitarian organizations. They satisfy our human desire for something new while getting a bargain. And we recycle our used items through them. The old adage, one person's garbage is another's treasure. And Kathy says, do you think that we have moved more toward a consumer economy in the last 6 years based on the overwhelming focus on for-profit capitalism and our domestic federal policy approaches? That is, lack of access to health care, lack of support for higher miles per gallon cars, lack of regulation enforcement, growth of the gap between the rich and the poor, and a lack of focus on public benefit. Let me go to more of your calls. We'll go to Santa Rosa. Margaret, good morning.
Oh, just a sec. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm trying to order my thoughts. I'm a first-time caller. I teach art, and I've been with students from all ages up to 80 years old. But what really stood out to me was this quote I wrote down from Adam Phillips, who I like a lot. Boredom is the anxious state of waiting to desire, and that's just huge. I wish that, I mean, I guess looking at the, as an amateur anthropologist, I wish that the human race, that our country so much valued beauty over, you know, the junk that's all around, that but as a teacher and for myself, I try to make such a safe place for what to bring out what's inside my students and myself. And our, when you make visible what's inside you, it's not always comfortable. But I think that's such a way of supporting our kids and making a better world. That I feel too strongly about this to say much more. But also, I was remembering the other day how much kids used to sing in classrooms, what a simple pleasure that is, and all those things that have gone missing in their, as they're being brought up, that they don't know what that kind of simple satisfaction and pleasure is available to them. I'm going to end...
Or even joy.
All of that. Yeah, all for free. As I say, for me, it's so huge I can barely talk about it, particularly in this situation. And also, was it Ben Franklin who said that beer is a sign that God loves us and wants us to be happy? I'll hang up now. Thanks.
Oh, sounds like some guys I went to college with. But thank you, Margaret, for that call. I didn't know that Franklin said that. And we'll go to Oros. Good morning, Oros.
Hey, so I wanted to bring a bit of economic perspective to this. It was asked earlier, what would happen to the economy if people didn't consume and they saved more? Well, ask any economist, from the far right-wingers who want to replace the income tax with a sales tax to discourage consumption and encourage saving, all the way across to the left, if you talk to Brad DeLong, who's on the program regularly, I mean, you know, he's the guy who favors adding on top of Social Security, you know, a government-subsidized savings plan to get people to save more, because people in America do not save enough. We have a national dis-savings problem, and it's bad for our economy because we need that money to be saved, to become available, to make loans to small businesses, to be, you know, invested by venture capitalists in new businesses and so on. And so I think this is, in terms of voluntary simplicity, it's good for the economy, and everybody agrees on that. So I'll listen off the air to what the author has to say about that.
All right, Judith Levine.
No, I agree with you. It's good for the economy, and it's good for individuals. But I do think that, you know, both economists and business and the government give us very mixed signals about that. You know, that consumer credit is, you know, wildly available and completely unregulated. And so people who cannot afford their credit are being given credit like crazy, and the government refuses to do anything about it. So so there's like, you know, I think there's a lot of dispute, and there's a lot of sort of macro anxiety about it, you know, that and companies that are having to grow from quarter to quarter in order to satisfy their shareholders, the whole thing.
I saw a cartoon recently where a guy sort of dressed up in salesman's garb was going out, and people were huddled on the street, homeless people, obviously, and was saying, you don't have your American Express card. All you have to do is sign up here. I mean, to some extent, it's an exaggeration and a bit of hyperbole, but nevertheless, that attempt to just increase numbers is rampant. It's pervasive. As I think you're suggesting, in terms of giving people credit or just extending them credit. And we'll extend to more of our callers. Anthony, you're on.
Hi. Boy, what a great subject. well, over the last, I want to talk about sort of dematerializing. Over the last 4 or 5 years, I have been purging my house over and over again until at this point, the only thing that I have in my house is things that I use. And anything new that I buy that comes into the house is actually bought, well, mostly on Craigslist, believe it or not. And so what I've done is I've reduced the amount of possessions, and everything I have I really value. I don't go shopping just for the sake of, you know, buying that new pair of shoes or whatever you want to call it. And if I need something, you know, I'll look and try to buy something used, because I think that as we buy new, we use more of the Earth's resources for instance, even a car. I mean, you go out and buy a new car, it takes a tremendous amount of resources to build a new car. So if you buy used, I think you contribute less to that cycle. The other thing is I've taught my children that, well, I pointed out to them that since birth, they've been inundated. They've been brainwashed to go out and buy. And what I told them was that there's an army of people in the United States particularly that have been brainwashed by advertising in the supermarkets, on TV, commercials, you name it, to buy products, to keep buying and buying and buying, and that they're going to have this urge to go out and buy for no reason at all because of this. And I don't think it's too far out to say that you know, the economy is based on consumption, and the advertising encourages that. So my hit on the whole thing is to just basically dematerialize and only own what you need.
I think you'd probably be more apt to say you're re-educating your children. Dematerializing suggests that you're making things disappear.
Right. In your family.
It's sort of like a joke. You know, when I say dematerialize, I mean you become less materialistic. And so Diminish the consumption. So when they left the house, they left with a suitcase. They left their trophies and those sort of things that they've gotten, you know, through school, but you know, they are not consumers. And what will happen to the economy? I don't know. But if each person individually reduces their consumption on a individual basis, then I think that'll go a long way in helping the world conserve its resources.
Well, Anthony, thank you for that call. And I think certainly Judith Levine is of one mind with you on that, right?
I am. But, you know, as I said before, I don't think we're going to solve this one by one. And we don't really have time. You know, the global warming people are warning us that we are on the edge of a precipice. And so we need to act collectively as citizens for great big policies that are going to reduce the use of fossil fuel at the very least. And, you know, the matter of decluttering, which is a big activity that people in the simple living movement do, my own feeling about it is it's a matter of taste. You know, I know some people who live perfectly happily, completely surrounded by stuff. So, you know, I don't think it's axiomatic that if you get rid of a lot of stuff, you're going to have a clearer mind.
Let's bring Marcy on. Marcy, thanks for waiting.
Well, thank you, Michael, and I'd like to thank your guest for her book and her comments. You know, I feel sad that she's spending most of her time justifying her stance. You know, it's not like she's an adulterer, a practicing adulterer, you know, preaching about not cheating on your spouse. But
how do you know?
anyway, and I think I also think it's a great topic. And it's not a criticism as much as just another comment. It sort of seems like I have this fan. I mean, I do recycle. I'm sort of just like avid recycler, and I conserve energy, but that's more out of to conserve money too. But I often have this fantasy that when I get rich, you know, I'll buy all organic and I'll buy all food in recycled containers because it seems like those things cost more, you know. And but I'm totally with, you know, I'm with your book, and I do think it's a one by one job. You know, I think the hecklers, I'm going to call them. I think your book might maybe threatens them and they're thinking that they have to just stop consuming anything, and I don't think that's what you're saying.
Well, Marcy, I'm afraid we're at the end of the hour here. I'm glad you got your comment in, though, and I thank you for the call, and I guess it's not really what Judith Levine is saying. If you want to find out more about what she's saying, consume her book. Use it to cover your head or for fireplace or whatever. It's called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping, and thank you for bringing about a lively and I think quite enlightening conversation here with us this morning, Judith.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we want to tell you who is responsible for the production of this program. We want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Elsa Chang. And our interns, who we traditionally thank on Thursday, Claire Liu, Lisa Rizaki, Christina Shaheen, and Katie Stanford. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.